caught this. I said, why is mental health care so ethically confusing? And it occurs to me, I don't know, is confusing a kind of category that we can use? I do have something in mind, and I'm hoping that in the questions you might help me get a bit more clarity on what I mean. I do mean something more than just complex or more than just contested. I think I want to say there's something about mental health care that's sort of irretrievably complex or irretrievably difficult. And I think it's irretrievably difficult because some of the things that we might use to try to make sense of ethics, things like being consistent or being sincere or not being hypocritical, aren't possible in mental health care. Okay, that's got your interest. Now, the structure of the session is... Hold on. Gotcha. Okay, so just three little parts, really. What I'm going to do is introduce some ideas about bureaucratic accountability to suggest that the institutional setting of mental health care is what makes it ethically confusing. So talk about 10, 15 minutes about that. Then I'm going to read a little bit of ethnography. So this is drawn from my PhD field work. It's all the people who are anonymized, I've concealed kind of where it took place and so on. But I'm going to kind of read that to give you some kind of really fine-grained data that I'm then going to try to kind of pick apart a little bit more. So I'm then going to kind of suggest, I suppose, two particular ways that we might think through just what is so confusing here. Why is it that the clinicians and the patients behave in the way that they do? Because I think it's really not obvious, and I think it'd be very easy to miss, actually. You know, it's the sort of thing I think in the earlier part of my fieldwork, these sorts of things were happening all the time, and I just didn't get it. And then later on, I began to think, beginning to kind of see what's going on. So yes, I'm going to discuss how the ethnography illustrates the problem of ethical confusion, I'm going to suggest two ways of thinking about it, then I'm going to raise some concerns about the implications and ask questions. Okay. So, bureaucratic accountability. Where would you go to find out about this? Obviously, the Oxford Handbook of Public Accountability, which I've sort of read, so you don't have to be honest, although it's a lot more interesting than you might think. So, at heart, bureaucratic accountability is an institutional relational arrangement in which an agent can be held accountable by another agent or institution. Now, holding to account sounds like a nice thing, but how do you do it bureaucratically? You do it through documentation. So if you're working in a bureaucratically accountable way, whatever it is that you're doing, you're likely to be documenting it, and then that documentation is likely to be a means by which you're going to be evaluated. Are you doing the right things? Are you behaving according to norms and so on? You also need arrangements where the actors can be questioned or investigated and judgments can be made. Very often, there's much more emphasis on negative judgments or sanctions rather than positive ones. So classically, and this is going to apply to your working lives, it applies to, kind of across the board really. People are increasingly subject to these sorts of mechanisms of bureaucratic accountability. A large part of your job isn't so much doing what you do, but it's recording what you do in such a way as to show that you've done it properly. So where does it come from? Well, it's associated with neoliberal institutional reform. So it's sort of coming out of Chicago School Economics. In the UK, these sorts of institutional reforms actually arrived in New Labour. So kind of in healthcare, and again, there may be people who know more about this than me in the room, but in healthcare, the Tories kind of set up the conditions for these sorts of changes to be made, but actually they didn't really kind of manifest until Tony Blair smiled his way into number 10. So government creates a distance. The idea really is that government creates a distance between itself and service providers. Rather than governments doing stuff for us, we kind of have these service providers that do it on the government's behalf and on our behalf. And that allows the service providers to be reconceived. So they start to be seen as businesses. That's like universities are increasingly being thought of as businesses, perhaps. But they're kind of special businesses because they're not just trying to maximize profit, but they're accountable. So it starts to become, if you work for one of these service providers, you're going to have to start documenting what you do quite carefully because you're going to be held accountable to stakeholders. So these are new ways of framing work that people do. The thought might be then that market mechanisms can make things efficient, whereas consumer choice can make a better fit between what services are being provided and what people really want. Potentially, people thought that might really kind of change healthcare. And then the role of the government is to monitor and evaluate. So the government has this kind of hands-off role. If you're a cynic, you say it means the government can't be blamed so directly for the failings of the NHS. But there are kind of serious ideas behind this as well. You know, maybe this is a good idea. I don't know. There are certain things that makes it appealing, I think. I mean, you know, this isn't like an automatically just like a terrible thing. It comes really, I think, from a very particular kind of moral imaginary. I mean, I think this sort of accountability comes from a world, we're imagining a world that's quite knowable and that's quite manipulable. And you might say, well, okay, outputs and inputs can be measured now. In an accountable bureaucracy, processes can be standardised and documented. Isn't this really quite a good thing? Individual actors can be monitored. Again, a good thing. It's going to stamp out malpractice if people aren't kind of doing what aren't able or willing or for some other reason doing what they're supposed to be doing. You're going to be able to get some hard evidence of that. Work can be evidenced and quality documented. And there are very good cases in healthcare of people doing things by custom or by tradition that actually turn out not to be very helpful. You can kind of you can do a trial, you can work out if it works, and then you can change what you're doing. You can even measure the efficiencies. And you can think also about safety. So, you know, all this kind of looks, it looks nice. And you might think, well, shouldn't this be making mental health care not more ethically confusing, but kind of ethically simpler? Shouldn't this make it really like a kind of walk in a kind of, you know, evidenced park of effectiveness and sort of streamlined efficiency? You can tell I'm going to say no. Now, here's the... Albert Einstein is not normally the anthropologist's go-to authority, but he did say this nice little thing which kind of captures part of the problem. Not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. And this is kind of, in a way, that's kind of the heart of what I'm concerned about here. But of course, anthropologists, I think, were quite quick on the scene to start thinking about accountability cultures or bureaucratic accountability, or the managerial revolution, as it's sometimes called. I think there's a reason why, really. Anthropologists do kind of long-term, immersive, non-invasive kind of field work. You know, we hang around, we watch what's going on, we listen to what people say they're doing, and then we watch what they really do. Always two different things. And so in a way, it's the methodology that's slowest to reach a firm view. Anthropology can be agnostic for an extremely long time. So if you come to a field and you want to find out about something and you have preformed questions, you've already made a few assumptions. And the beauty of anthropology, the strength of it, is we don't necessarily do that. You know, the field determines our research questions to a certain extent, at least. Marilyn Strathern edited this kind of key early volume, Audit Cultures. She looked at where the technologies had come from. She said, the concept of the audit has broken loose from its moorings in finance and accounting. Its own expended presence gives it the power of a descriptor seemingly applicable to all kinds of reckonings, evaluations, and measurements. She was particularly interested in higher education and the way that, in a way, what people do is being transformed by this process of documentation. It's like the cart's pulling the horse, really. It's like this stuff that's supposed to be just checking that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing starts to change what it is that they're doing. And there are particular kind of concerns. So David Graeber has written recently a book called The Utopia of Rules, which is a bit of a kind of rant kind of book, as some of David Graeber's are. There's high-quality ethnography to support this, but I quite like the punchy statement. He says, bureaucratic knowledge is all about schematization. In practice, bureaucratic procedures invariably mean ignoring all the subtleties of real social existence and reducing everything to preconceived mechanical or statistical formulae. Whether it's a matter of forms, rules, statistics, or questionnaires, it's always a matter of simplification. I think that should raise a kind of concern if we're thinking about mental health care. Surely, ignoring all the subtleties of real social existence is a risky thing to be doing in mental health, where it's surely that the subtleties of real social existence are what bring people into their clinic in the first place. So there's kind of a concern about whether an accountable bureaucracy is really a very good fit for this kind of mental health work. There's a kind of landmark ethnography of mental health care by Tanya Lerman, published in 2000, which I kind of recommend for people who are interested. She's really writing about how psychoanalytic and psychodynamic psychiatry in the States was superseded by a more biological, pharmaceutical-driven psychiatry. And she's, in a way, she offers a kind of quite a subtle, quite a multifaceted kind of account. And something that she doesn't develop, but which she does nonetheless notice, is that part of what's going on is that you have a lot of psychiatrists having to make phone calls to the insurance providers who pay for treatment. They have to justify everything they do. You've got a patient, you think they need to be hospitalized, you've got to, you start to call the insurance company. If they've been, if they've cleared 6 days in a ward, but you think that the patient is a suicide risk and you want them to stay another 6 days, you have to make a phone call. So there's an awful lot of liaising between the psychiatrist or other responsible clinician and the insurance company. And she writes like this. She says, the more time they, the psychiatrists, spend on the phone with insurance agents negotiating for a six-day admission to be extended to 9 days because a patient is still suicidal, the more administrative interviews they need to do, the more discharge summaries they need to type, the less the ways of thought and experience of psychodynamic psychotherapy fit in, the less they seem relevant or even real, and the more psychiatrists are willing to fall back on the ideological position that the cause and treatment of mental illness is biological and psychopharmacological. I think this is a really interesting observation. So at first thought, we think of, oh, bureaucracy is a kind of iron cage, that kind of Weberian idea. You know, you put a clinician or actually any other worker, but since we're talking about mental health, we're putting them into an accountable bureaucracy. That will constrain the choices that they make, perhaps. Perhaps that will force them to behave in ways that they might prefer not to behave, but still, it's still the bureaucratic frame. What Lerman's suggesting is a bit more than that, really. She's saying the ways of imagining the world, the ways of thinking about mental illness, the ways of treating mental illness that best fit form filling in, documentation, the mechanisms of accountability start to feel more real. Now, lots of kind of anti-psychiatry people would say, oh, Big Pharma has completely, you know, taken over and corrupted psychiatry. But think what a different case that Lerman's making here, or at least giving us the resources to argue here. It's not so much as Big Pharma, it's the institution itself. It's just quite difficult to be psychodynamic and produce notes which don't expose you to risk as a clinician. So I think this is a kind of very important idea. So just up the road, Nayana Kumatur has written a really lovely book about bureaucracy. She's really talking about government institutions in the Himalayas. But one of the kind of centres of what she's writing about is how, these are government bureaucrats, are being asked to do things that aren't quite doable. And you begin to realise that what bureaucratic expertise is something representational. It's not quite so much what you do, it's about learning to be very good at representing what you may or may not have done. She puts it like this. Agents of the state know that rules can never be followed to the letter. Their energies are directed instead at making it appear as if the illegibilities have been overcome, as if orders have been followed. So, you know, this is a kind of really striking thing that, for example, it's slightly similar remarks are made by David Moss in his account of development work, that successful development projects are the ones that you can represent according to current trends in what a successful project looks like. What happens on the ground? Who cares? So, there's, I think, reason for disquiet. I'm trying to be polemical too, as you can tell, so I'm hoping we're going to get some nice questions. Now, so I've suggested, I think, kind of four reasons why accountability might be a source of ethical confusion, and without wanting to be heavy-handed, I'm just going to remind you of them before I read my bit of ethnography. So, there's the thought that imported bureaucratic mechanisms don't necessarily fit mental health care. Like, even if we think these are good things, there's a real problem of how well do these things fit together. Bureaucratic mechanisms are associated with accountability are reductive and simplistic. Mental health care is complex and nuanced. Understandings of mental health that are suited to accountable practice are favoured, whilst others lose ground or seem less real. And expertise as a clinician blurs with the representational skills of a bureaucrat. Okay, so I'm hoping now this starts to look, if not ethically confusing, at least very complex. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about Jill, Giles, and Viv. But I'm going to read this out because the detail is the key thing. Okay. Viv and her family were widely described as being well known to services. It's an ominous phrase. It means they received input from a wide range of sources, social services, mental health care, and the police, as well as a local charity. Viv recently came to the attention of a mental health team that I was working with following the arrest of one of her sons for a string of serious sexual offences. The case was locally notorious and received extensive media coverage. Viv was briefly admitted to a psychiatric ward as an informal or voluntary patient. She was discharged a few days later and was due to come and see a CPN called Jill, who I worked with quite a lot. I asked Jill about Viv. What kind of person is she? What kind of care do the team provide? Jill said that Viv was depressed and anxious. She's feeling guilty about her son and his crimes and hated by the other members of the local community. She talks about wanting to kill herself and, in the view of the team, she presents a substantial suicide risk. But, Jill stressed, they want to provide the minimum care possible for Viv. I asked why. Jill replied, "We don't believe Viv has a mental illness." She explained, "They think that Viv is depressed, but she doesn't suffer from a depressive disorder. She's anxious, but she doesn't suffer from an anxiety disorder. The reason for this is that her distress seems broadly proportionate to the environment." Jill describes it as normal depression. She added that Viv has plenty to feel depressed and anxious about. "How would we feel," Jill asked, "if we were in her position?" Jill articulated this in terms of stressors. The level of stress is very high, and so the level of distress is very high. However, Jill also explained that Viv's personality is being taken into account. Jill said that the team feels that Viv has personality issues or definite personality traits. This is coded language. Maybe I should just insert four. We're hinting that we think she has a personality disorder, but we haven't diagnosed her with a personality disorder. That's kind of what that means. She says that the team take the view that these personality issues are important when thinking about appropriate treatment. Jill put it to me this way. Mental illness is something that could happen to anyone, to me and to you. Who you are doesn't make any difference. It can just come and take your life away. But with personality, it's you who's the problem. She went on to say that personality problems have their origin in childhood, either in abuse or neglect. As I understand it, she regards Viv's childhood as causing dysfunctions or pathologies that are distinct from mental illnesses, but of the same order of magnitude. She says that these problems go on to shape character such that the patient finds it hard to lead a functional or fulfilling life. She'll talk more about how Viv's depression and anxiety are caused in part by her personality. She has poor coping skills, for example, at a time when she has a lot to cope with. Jill says that like many people with personality traits, Viv is poor at self-soothing. I notice that Jill's reticent when talking about these issues. She goes on, but she talks in a rather cautious way, almost like a politician in a tricky interview, choosing her words carefully. I felt unsure how sincere Jill was about Viv's personality issues. She was able to talk convincingly in a way that would be required for team meetings or medical documentation, but I thought her heart wasn't really in it. This gave some of her words a slight ironic edge. Now, at times during fieldwork, I sensed the rhetorical power of a particular variety of understatement. On one occasion, during a team meeting, which a female CPN, community psychiatric nurse, described to the team how a male patient had been sexually aggressive towards her, very sexually aggressive, in the normal world, had been incredibly sexually aggressive towards her. In the world of mental health care, they have to get used to a lot of stuff. So let's just say sexually aggressive towards her. She used phrases when describing it to the team like, "Oh, he had a really poor sense of personal boundaries. And I did detect some impulse control issues." These anodyne, non-judgmental, bureaucratized terms acquire rhetorical force through understatement. They're immensely effective. You know, the room goes quiet when someone says things like that. But with Jill, I felt we're in some sort of grey area as well. I don't think she accepted the personality disorder model, but neither did she reject it. With regard to Viv, her stance was undefined. Jill went on to say that instead of looking to her own resources, Viv might already have become dependent on services. She wanted to be in contact with Jill every day, either by phone or in person. Jill seemed wary. She thought this might lead to Viv losing skills where she might benefit from improving them. "I know it's hard," said Jill, "but life is hard. You have to learn how to cope." She said she didn't want Viv exaggerating her distress to secure attention. Manipulative behaviour like that is expensive and it diverts us from our real job. Viv could easily become a burden on services, while in the same process losing her autonomy and self-reliance.
In their dealings with Viv, Jill said the team had made sure not to prescribe Viv any medication. Their aim was to restrict the scope of any dependency they may create by basing her treatment on generic support offered by Jill. Now, I was quite excited to meet Viv by this stage, I have to say. But before, that may say what a strange man I am, but before we go to meet Viv, Jill steps into the waiting room to introduce me and to ask if it's okay for me to be present in the appointment. I stand behind her as she introduces me as a researcher in medical anthropology. Viv is sitting with her sister, who, we understand, will stay in the waiting room. Viv seems slightly expectant, excited. Jill stresses I don't have to be there, that the appointment can go on without me, but her tone suggests there's no reason why not. Viv seems pleased I'm there. She asks what medical anthropology is. I explain, I was a research student, and actually, I thought she was a little disappointed I wasn't more senior, but nonetheless, she was pleased that I was around. So, having established I'll join them, Viv rises quickly, and we walk together down a long corridor and enter a tiny room. It seems too small, and it's made worse, frankly, by my presence. Airless and cramped, there's barely enough space for a table and three chairs. We're forced into physical proximity. Jill sits on the other side of the table, and I sit next to Viv as if I'm sort of her ally. Jill begins by talking quite neutrally about how things been going. Viv starts to talk about how depressed she's been. She says she can't sleep and she finds it painful to be alive. Jill nods, listens, and asks simple questions. Is Viv in contact with her son? Remember that who's committed the offences, currently being held on remand. She says no. Is she in touch with her other children? She says yes. Jill is supportive, but without offering opinions or advice. She tends to repeat back what Jill says, or make remarks such as, that must be very painful. I can see how difficult that is. Viv starts to discuss how she feels that her husband is supportive, but doesn't understand. She also says she's getting forgetful at work. She presents herself as overwhelmed by her feelings, and also kind of baffled by them as well. As she talks, she scans Jill quite carefully. She says it's all too much to cope with. She describes how she comes downstairs in the night, unable to sleep and tormented by intense, overwhelming feelings. Hours go by, sitting alone on the sofa, not knowing what to do. Viv continued, saying, she's thinking of killing herself, that she very much wants to do it, but she's held back by a concern for her younger children. There's a pause as Jill offers reassurance and comfort. Viv goes on, I know drinking doesn't help. You've told me about that, and I don't do it when I feel terrible. But she starts to cry. She says, I can't manage. It's all too much. Hunched over the table, her body tenses and shakes. She hugs herself and gasps for breath. Jill hands her a box of tissues. She waits for Viv to compose herself, sitting perfectly still. Take your time, Viv. It's okay. There's no hurry. Just take your time. Viv returns to the topic of medication. She says she doesn't want tablets because she knows they don't help, but she knows she needs something because nobody could bear what she's bearing. Nobody could go through what she's going through. Might there be some tablets that could help? Something that help her cope, to take the pain away? Otherwise, suicide's always there. Jill asked if Viv might want to go and if she might want us to go and speak to the doctor about antidepressants. She said yes. We got up and went to find Giles, the consultant psychiatrist. As we were leaving, Jill said, you'll be all right, won't you, for a few minutes while I speak to the doctor? Viv agreed that she would be fine. Now, Giles's office is further down the corridor. Jill explains to Giles what's happening. She says Viv seems very depressed and is talking of suicide. The risk seems to be real, so might it be worth giving her antidepressants? Giles says he can see there might be a justification for prescribing antidepressants. Then he asked me what I think. Now, I'm out of my depth. I don't know what to say. So he talks through a possible rationale, that she's very distressed, that antidepressants might help a bit, that she's at risk of both suicide and of developing a depressive illness. And, anyway, antidepressants won't do any harm. Giles finds several ways to justify prescribing antidepressants, but his tone suggests he's slightly flippant. I don't think he has any expectation that the medicine will be effective, perhaps even that she'll even take the pills. He went on to say the notoriety of Viv's son's crimes make her a very high-profile case, and the team needs not to take unnecessary risks, because they'll be looking after Viv for the next 6 months at least, as they wait for the trial. It might be safer to put her on medication. So the three of us return to the room. Viv seems much calmer and visibly brightens when she sees Giles. There's no room for another chair, so he has to crouch down in front of her. She's almost flirtatious. You're a very tall doctor, aren't you? When, later, she writes down her date of birth on the prescription, she jokes coquettishly about her age. Shouldn't be telling her that, should I? Giles is undeflected and impassive. He talks her through the options. His role is to impart information. It's clear from the outset that she's getting the tablet she wants. He says there shouldn't be any side effects, but you can never be sure. He gives her a leaflet, writes out a prescription, and the meeting's over. So I want to ask two questions about, well, maybe you're going to have more questions, but I'm going to ask two questions about Jill, Giles, and Viv. The first one is, how would Jill and Giles approach Viv if the institutional setting were changed, but Viv remains the same? I think it would make a huge difference. I mean, think of how Jill started to talk to me about Viv. She's guilty and isolated. People hate her. It's kind of understandable. Her son did really terrible things. I mean, he's got a life sentence for what he did. But she can't. You don't treat psychiatric services are not there to treat guilt. So it has to be depression and anxiety. So it has to be reframed. It's not really what Viv is talking about is very understandable kind of human responses. But it's been reframed in health terms. And then there's this peculiar category of personality issues, personality traits. It's a category surely that's all about dealing with risk, really. It's all about how do we take steps so that we handle two particular risks. Because really, Viv is risky. Viv is risky of committing suicide or of disengaging with services. They don't want either, basically. They don't also want her to become dependent on services. And the category of personality disorder, or these kind of vaguer personality traits, I think is organized around those institutional needs. But those institutional needs are derived from the institution. This isn't really all that much now about what Viv is like. It's about the position that Jill and Giles are put in by the way that their work has been bureaucratized. Remember, so that we can have market mechanisms in the NHS. So I would suggest if the institutional setting were different, things could look really quite different. But likewise, how would Viv approach Jill and Giles if the institutional setting were changed, but her predicament remained the same? Because I think it's quite easy to look at how Viv interacts. I very much like Jill and Giles. They're really committed professionals and they do jobs I couldn't do. I just could not put myself through the things that they put themselves through. But it's also clear they don't like Viv, actually. And Viv has very, very few cards to play. And in a sense, she's really astute. She is exactly what people told NHS patients should be, in that she's seeking the best she can get in her situation. She's got one currency, and that's her risk, and she knows that. So she initially, when she's talking to Jill, she initially gives Jill a kind of gift. I do follow your advice about drinking. I'm doing what you're saying. But she gradually escalates her in a sense, demands, because why shouldn't she go for the most that she can get? And the most that she can get, definitely, is the big, tall psychiatrist to come in the room, because the hierarchy is like that, man. You know, I mean, it's kind of clear. You want the best treatment, you get the most important people, and she knows how to do it, and she does escalate it. I don't think it's very nice. I mean, Jill has a sense of this, I think, and I understand it's annoying for her, but I also think Viv's her position is defined by this position. You know, I could imagine, you know, she may behave wholly differently if the stakes were different, if she didn't present a risk, if there were different ways of talking about her distress. Everything is being kind of set up, by the institutional state. Everything, I'm exaggerating a little, but you can see what a decisive influence it's having on this. So I'm going to suggest two ways now of thinking about this, about why this is all now so morally confusing. From kind of recent publications, really. See what you think about whether you think these ideas help clarify what's going on. So the first is a book published a couple of years back by Bernardo Zacca. He's a political scientist. He did ethnographic work in a government office in the States, And he's interested in the moral consequences of impossible situations. So the bureaucrats that he observed were constantly, they have a certain amount of discretion in making decisions about access to benefits and things of that sort. So they're constantly having to exercise judgment. They can't just follow the rules. There are rules, but you know, lots of cases have lots of uncertainty and ambiguity. So he says that they're kind of torn between wanting to do the best for each individual client, trying to be fair, treat clients equally, but also be efficient so that you don't start to behave in a way that isn't sustainable. You know, you have other clients, you have colleagues, you have a certain amount of resources and so on. And these different kind of interests or these different kind of sentiments clash. They're just not, there's no kind of consistent way of dealing with it. So he says that if the risk is that people move towards just one of those things, they start to become like either an enforcer who's just kind of following the rules, or they become excessively good for certain kind of favoured clients, or you know, they become like a team player but kind of screw the clients. He says because they're placed in these impossible positions, it's a kind of erosion of them as kind of moral subjects. He says the problem is not that bureaucrats lose their capacity for sound moral reasoning, but that their moral perception and role conception that feed into such reasoning become overly narrow and specialised. Now, in other words, so overly narrow and specialised precisely means just acting in these kind of stereotyped ways. So it's as if they lose sight of the job necessarily being impossible, necessarily involving contradictions. They resolve the contradictions, but it makes them bad bureaucrats. I think, actually, that Giles and Jill don't do this. I think what you can see is throughout that ethnography, they haven't just collapsed into a single kind of frame, a single kind of way of doing it. So sure, they start out by thinking, don't give Viv antidepressants. And then they say, oh no, let's give Viv antidepressants. They start out saying, oh, she's got a personality disorder type problem. They then say, I mean, just in a matter of minutes, no, actually she's probably got a kind of depressive disorder. So they come, but that's because not much has changed really in Viv, but other things are in play. You can't really understand their decisions just thinking about Viv and Viv's health needs. Neither should you, because you have to always be thinking about the bigger picture. That's what a life of a bureaucrat is. You shouldn't be thinking about only one kind of thing. They have to maintain relations with Viv. If Viv just said, well, screw this, I'm not going to come and see my psychiatrist anymore, that will be problematic. All these meetings, Giles is having meetings with the police, they're coordinating in all sorts of ways to make sure that the family's kind of in one piece until they get to trial. That just can't happen. I mean, if I was being polemical, I would say that's why Viv now has depression. I mean, you know, if we think that clinical depression means a psychiatrist saying you have depression, she's now got depression, but she's got it for these institutional reasons. And I think, looked at from this point of view, Giles and Jill are being entirely honourable. They're doing their job really well. It's just that it looks weird if you think that their job is just healthcare. Okay, here's my second kind of take on kind of what's going on. This is a book by Paolo Haywood. It's about queer activism in Bologna. It's a super interesting field. But Haywood talks about quite a lot of the people he works with. They are critical of, but also do themselves a certain sort of hypocrisy that he gets quite interested in. And this is, he calls it a double morality. So this, an example of this is where somebody in public is very loving to their spouse and upholds a kind of a sort of ethic of we must be faithful to each other and must always be kind of loving and attentive and so on. But then when they go home, they're kind of cheating on their spouse, they behave in a completely different way. So there's a kind of two forms of behaviour. And Haywood says, well, the kind of classic way of dealing with this is to say you've got two ethics going on. You've got, you know, the ethics at home and the ethics in the public, and people are just jumping between the two. And I think there are situations where that's, you know, actually that's the case, where people just have these kind of multiple worlds. I mean, it leads to certain kind of intellectual problems, I think, but still, it kind of makes sense. It's a coherent thing. But Haywood struggled that maybe something slightly different really is happening, at least some of the time. He's saying that and here maybe the quote's helpful, people might have a relationship to ethical injunctions in which adherence is not always expected.
which does not involve a negation of the universal applicability of the moral conventions. What it does provide for certain ways of relating to such conventions in which the possibility of their betrayal in a certain form is already allowed for. So the thought might be, in a way, okay, if you're cheating on your spouse, you kind of know that at least part of you is still tied to the fact that that might be a bad thing. That you're contradicting those, that you may kind of uphold certain values whilst consistently breaking. I mean, I don't know. What I like about this is, I think this is what happens if you conduct, if you're gathering data and you keep on gathering data and you are very slow to reach a judgment about what's really happening. You start to capture how kind of messy and ambiguous and confusing, potentially, kind of human lives are. But I think, say, for Giles and Jill, their equivocation is perhaps, it could be understood in this way. I'm not quite sure what they think some of the time, but maybe that's right. Maybe there's a certain advantage, maybe there's something better about not being entirely sincere all the time, about being a hypocrite some of the time. The situation requires it. In a sense, I think they still have some fidelity to kind of, you know, to their understanding of medicine. I think Giles, you know, if you meet him in the pub after, he will give an account of what's going on, which suggests that these are all medical decisions. He kind of knows that not as well. But I think they also are. I think that, you know, this might be possible that they're simultaneously both. So, okay, So I've got a kind of few questions for you to ponder, as I hope you're going to leap in with questions that are both furious, but also help bring me intellectual clarity. What I'm trying to suggest really is that for all three players in the ethnography that I'm describing, which I want to present really as, this is a common situation. It's just an extreme version of something that's happening all the time. So most clients, if you're a psychiatrist, they don't have a son who's just done a massive crime. But I can assure you that psychiatrists constantly talk about what's this going to look like on the front page of the Daily Mail tomorrow morning. I mean, they're constantly aware of, you know, feel being scrutinized, feel a risk of reputational damage. So this is just an extreme form of everyday. That's why I think it's a good moment to try to describe and analyze. And I think it's ethically confusing because it just isn't possible to be consistent. It isn't possible for them to do their job well and behave consistently and with sincerity. They have to sort of half engage with ideas. You know, I've got a fairly strong feeling that Jill basically thinks that idea of personality disorder is rubbish, to be honest. I mean, I know both these people really quite well socially, and basically she does. I mean, you know, she doesn't really think this is true, but her job requires her to do it, and I think surely it's the right thing in a way. You know, so her engagement with this kind of thing isn't a fixed thing. It's not like she believes it or she doesn't. I think sometimes she does, sometimes she half does. When she goes home, probably a little bit less. You know, it's kind of all over the place. And I think so this potentially has kind of wider thoughts. I think I don't see how, if I'm not quite sure how any of them can be good in the circumstance. In a situation of such ethical confusion, I think they're necessarily slightly screwed. I think they're necessarily always going to go home feeling they've probably done the wrong thing, and they probably are also always doing the wrong thing, because that's how you also do the right thing. I mean, I think that's what ethical confusion probably means. Anthropologists of ethics often like to present it as a way of orienting yourself in the world. You have a kind of ethical schema, or you have certain kind of technologies of self, ethics of kind of self-improvement or changing yourself to try to make sense of things. But I'm not quite sure in this case. I think actually this is more like the fallout from a very complex situation. I don't think the ethical intuitions are ever going to bring clarity to any of these players, and including Viv as well. And I think this kind of leaves potentially questions about to what degree do epistemic movements like evidence-based medicine or clinical categories such as personality disorder or mental disorder and clinical projects like patient self-management or the recovery model arise out of the institutional setting of mental health care? And who would have dreamt up any of these things, perhaps, if the institutional demands were different? Should we continue to assume that the ethics and episteme of accountable bureaucracy are consistent with the clinical interests of patients? And how should we weigh up the costs and benefits of accountability? Good. Thank you.